So we're studying the tonight the Ramban, Maimonides, often confused with Rambam, Maimonides. And in Hebrew, those are acronyms. So Rambam stands for Rabbeinu, or Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. So that's the Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbi Moses ben Maimon. Maimonides is Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. So it's whatever. But so I'm showing you a clip from Israeli television. It's in Hebrew. It's a short clip, and I hope you can get the humor of it by the motions. It's set in a cafe, like a Starbucks, you know, like that kind of a cafe in medieval Spain in the 1200s. And so the woman calls first, you know, the next order, Rambam. I mean, you'll see her, she's calling in a shofar. And this guy comes up, who says, I think it's my order, but you have the name wrong. I'm not Rambam, I'm Ramban. And she says, Rambam, it's you? And she's calling everybody over, and she's calling over her friend, and says, who are you crazy about? And she says, Rabbeinu Tam? No, who else? It's a Rambam, you know, and they go on and on with all his books and this and that. He's doing his best to say, no, it's not me. I mean, this is funny to a very, very small group of people. That's part of what's so funny about it. And there's a show called HaYehudim Ba'im, The Jews Are Coming, which spoofs many moments, a lot of Torah, in a very biting, critical way. But this one is not biting, it's just funny. And finally, he gets people to listen. That he's the Ramban, he's no, Ramban, you'll see him. And then they think he's like a liar, and you know, he says, but she, oh, it's her fault, you know, the woman who called. Anyway, so they diss him and they leave, and they curse at him basically. Says, fine, I'll take my order. And she says, you know, pomodoro, whatever, you know, pesto, yeah, we all understand that. And something with challah. And he says, it's not challah, it's chalav. Or the, I don't remember the other. And so you'll see how, it's not the challah, it's the challah, it's milk, or not milk and challah, I forget which way it goes. You'll see it. It's all of 2.5 minutes. And let's see. Me and my, good. I'm crazy about you. I'm worried about you. I read all your books. The Talmud, this, the that. The Aristotelian stuff, you didn't like, kill me with that. I'm not really you're a giant. He wants to say something. It's beautiful here, the atmosphere. I'm not
a Rambam.
Haramban.
Lo bam, ban, benon, ban, chin. Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. גם אני מלומד, גם אני חוקר במקרא, אני רופא, אני פילוסוף, מדען, ואני מאוד שמח להיות
שיש
כאן במקום הזה כל כך אנשים
שמוכנים.
למה אמרת שאתה הרמב״ם?
אני לא אמרתי שאני הרמב״ם. היא קראה בה...
עכשיו אתה אומר שאני מטומטמת?
סליחה,
שאני רק קובעית פשוטה ולא כמוך הרמב״ם הגדול.
רמב״ן.
You should be embarrassed. You should be ashamed of yourself. We'll forget everything that happened. I'll take my turn.
לחם שור, פסטה פומדורו וקפה על חלב.
חלב, לא חלב, חלב.
Anyway, I think it's hysterical.
We will not forget the
difference. That's family.
It is a funny picture.
Cute.
That's it. I don't know how to okay. We made it work.
And they all fit in New York.
Anyway, as I said, it's funny to a small group of people, but it's on national television in Israel. So you are now part of the group of people that appreciates the confusion between the Rambam and the Ramban. And my rabbinic colleagues, we study and classical commentary week in, week out, we often make reference to this Ramban. So if you want to Google, there are a few episodes that have subtitles, a few, and they use biblical scenes to actually undermine the current political stuff happening in Israel, which, like here, there's plenty to undermine. Well, Hayehudim Ba'im. I don't know if the Jews are coming. I don't know if you could Google it in English, but you can. If you Google Hayehudim Ba'im, you'll get to some episodes and you can see others. Okay. So I can't teach the Ramban without making reference to this adorable video. And so I want to tell you a story. I told it actually in 2003 from the Bima on Rosh Hashanah after Mel Gibson's The Passion, Passion of the Christ came out. This is how it began. In a small medieval town, the local priest challenges the Jews of the community to a debate. Should they win the debate, they will be able to stay. But should they lose, they will have to leave immediately. One person will need to represent the Jewish community, and the debate the priest announces will, of course, be on the theological merits of Judaism and Christianity. In addition, the debate will be conducted not in words, but in the language of symbols. Fear strikes at the core of the community. Who will represent them? Who will be willing to shoulder their responsibility for the fate of all the inhabitants? No one. And so they draw lots, and the unlucky card is drawn by a poor, uneducated chicken farmer. The fateful day arrives, and the entire town gathers in the central square in front of the church. The priest and the Jew step up onto the platform. With a grand gesture, the priest swings his arm high and wide. The Jew hesitates for a moment and points straight to the ground. Next, the priest points two fingers directly at the little chicken farmer. The Jew quickly points one finger at the priest. And finally, the priest pulls out a piece of ripened, molded cheese from his pocket, and the chicken farmer pulls out a hard-boiled egg. "I give up," the priest calls out. "He won. They all won. They can stay." The two men climb down platform, and the officials and villagers follow the priest into the church. We don't understand. What happened? What did you say? What do you say? I said the priest, I spread out my hand to the heavens, indicating that the important thing is eternal life, to be saved and to go to heaven. He answered me by saying that it's important how we live in this life here on earth. Then I lifted two fingers, indicating that there's a force of evil and a force of good, Satan and the Lord. He lifted one finger, telling me that there was only one God in the universe. And finally, I pulled out some old and molded cheese to tell him that the covenant of God with the Jewish people was old, that its time was over. And he pulled out an egg, telling me that the Jewish people was eternally young. Meanwhile, the Jewish community gathered around the chicken farmers. So what happened? I don't know exactly, he said. First, he raises his arm and tells us to get out of here. And I pointed to the ground to tell him we were going to stay put. And then he points two fingers at me like he's going to put out my eyes. So I quickly raise my hand to block him. And finally, he took out his lunch, so I took out mine. So I continue. This is long before I knew we were going to teach this. The story I just told you, of which there are many variations, is a mirror of the real situations in which Jews found themselves over the past many centuries. Dialogues or disputations were conducted to prove the superiority of absolute validity of one faith over the other. Most of these disputations, however, did not have such happy endings. Losing the debate often meant either forced conversions or expulsions, but winning the debate was often not much better. Nachmanides, the 13th century Spanish rabbi and scholar, philosopher, Kabbalist, poet and physician, was involved in a disputation recorded by both Jewish and Christian sources. In the year 1263, King James I coerced him into a public disputation in Barcelona with Pablo Cristiani, who was a Jew who had converted to Catholicism. Okay, so that's where we're going to pick it up. So we're going to look at like one page from Jane Berger's book, and then we're going to study some commentary. So if you pass these around, thank you. So we're starting on page 107. So we're going to read just half of each of these pages. And most of the time we've been studying, we're still under Muslim sovereignty. So this is the transition into Christian sovereignty, our evening tonight. So on 107, would someone read for a while? The Jews were not were most reluctant. Anybody? Thank you, David.
The Jews were most reluctant to engage in any religious debates with either Muslims or Christians. Such debates were fraught with peril, a no-win situation for the Jewish participant. If he spoke freely, he might arouse the ire of his powerful opponents, but if he was too submissive, he could demoralize his brethren. Therefore, as defender of the faith, the Nachmanides had to satisfy two audiences simultaneously. He had to counter Christiani's missionizing arguments by proving that his opponent did not truly understand Judaism, but he also had to justify the belief of Jews in the classical sources of their religion. The Christian participant was also not unaware of the palpable dangers of religious debate. Should he fail, he might engender doubts among Christian believers, or even subject himself to mockery from his Jewish opponent. On the other hand, if he succeeded, he might inspire a wave of Jewish apostasy, or less desirable from the official perspective, an upsurge in persecution of the Jews. The stakes were extremely high.
Okay, someone else want to pick it up? Thank you. Want to just take it around the room? Do you mind?
Okay. Two versions of the Disputation of Barcelona have survived. Nachmanides' own record in Hebrew and a Latin account penned by his foes. Despite the varying points of view, both agree that the rabbi succeeded in speaking openly during the four or five sessions held during the week of July 20. Obviously, Nachmanides had prepared himself very well. From prior encounters, he was familiar with Christiani's technique, daring and innovating for its time, of reading the Talmud Christologically. In other words, just as Christian apologists had for centuries used the Old Testament to prove the truth of Christianity, the friar tried to use the Talmud as a proof text. He could certainly achieve a major victory if he could convincingly demonstrate that this quintessential Jewish source showed Jesus to be the Messiah, thus nullifying the continued relevance of the ceremonial and legal traditions being practiced by the Jews.
As Nachmanides expected, Christiani brought up an obscure text he had found by scouring through the vast Talmudic corpus. It declared that the Messiah was born on the day of the destruction of the temple. In dealing with this text, the rabbi faced a serious dilemma. If he denied the authenticity and binding authority of a rabbinic text, he would be placed in an unfavorable light with the Jews and might even call the cherished messianic tradition into question, which would be troubling and even traumatic for his brethren in the audience.
Messianism was on the rise, and in part because we have a very imperiled Jewish community. We saw elements of that in Yehuda Halevi's poetry, this longing for messianic redemption. So this is on the rise. So that's at stake for Nachmanides here too, to in any way undermine belief in a Messiah. But he doesn't want to fall into the trap of Jesus being the Messiah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On the other hand, he could not accept Christiani's reading of the text. Nachmanides' solution was to dismiss the importance of the passage. Specifically, he argued spiritedly that only the legal part of the Talmud, known as the Halakha, was authoritative to Jews. The text cited by Christiani was in the sermonic and homiletic body of the Talmudic material, the Agadah.
So this Halakha, which is legal, and Agadah, which is metaphor and story.
Furthermore, the rabbi argued, even if the text had been in the Halakha, it would prove nothing about the messiahship of Jesus. He was long dead when the temple was destroyed. But in drawing distinctions between different layers of tradition in the Talmud, Nachmanides was using an argument unknown outside limited circles of learned Jews. The suggestion that any part of the Talmud was not an authoritative guide to Jewish life could prove in the long run to be confusing at best or deeply demoralizing.
So this is something we take for granted, looking at the layers and the compilation of texts and the various literary traditions, the redaction of sacred scripture. But this is, he's radical in extending it beyond a small circle of people. We're going to read a little bit in his commentary, but expanding it to a wider audience, a more common audience. If something I say isn't clear, please ask for clarification. Okay, questions, things that don't make sense or that are confusing or troubling, don't stay with them. Get clarification. Okay, let's keep going.
The king took an active part in the debate, interjecting a question now and then to bolster his friar's arguments or to clarify a moot point. Despite his efforts and the fervent arguments of Christiani, however, Nachmanides was so impressive that the Franciscans asked that the debate be discontinued, and the crowd in attendance became unruly. James I ended the disputation, but he supposedly remarked to Nachmanides, "Never have I seen anyone who was in the wrong argue so well as you have." He is also reported to have provided the rabbi with some monetary compensation, presumably for the mastery of his performance.
James
I.
Who was the first?
Is that in the James I Bible?
No. He's hundreds of years later in England. This is
James
I.
Of Scotland.
Scotland.
Okay.
After the disputation, Nachmanides lingered in Barcelona in order to rebut some charges raised by de Penafort in a compulsory synagogue the following Sabbath.
So by this point, the Christian rulers of northern Spain, we're in northern Spain, Barcelona, had issued edicts that Catholic clerics had the right at any time to enter any synagogue and force people during services to listen to sermons about Christianity. So that's the reference right here.
Compulsory
sermon in the synagogue the following Sabbath.
Thereafter, he returned to Gerona and composed his account, apparently giving a copy to the bishop of the city. In this fashion, it may have fallen into the hands of the Dominicans, who in any event charged the rabbi with writing blasphemy. The self-assured tone of his writing so enraged the order that he was forced into exile in 1267, leaving his family behind and settling alone in Palestine.
So this is how it doesn't have a happy ending. He won the debate, but he lost.
Meanwhile, James I acceded to Christiani's request to be allowed to missionize among the Jews of Aragon. He also set up a commission to purge all Jewish books of blasphemy within 3 months. Thus was the main thrust of Raymond de Penafort's program against the Jews fulfilled, and the victory of Nachmanides, if victory it was, nullified.
We're reading two more paragraphs.
The disputation of Barcelona is one of those historical turning points whose full importance becomes clear only with hindsight. We can see now that the personality and interests of Nachmanides reflect a new intellectual reality in Spain, for the traditions of Northern European Jewry were gaining wider currency as Christian Spain became increasingly detached from the Islamic world. Talmudic scholarship had become a new focal point of learning among the Sephardic elite, challenging the former unique blend of science and philosophy with rabbinics.
So all that beautiful science philosophy that we glimpsed together through the early poetry is now being replaced by the primary focus of Jewish study in Northern Europe, which was yeshiva-based Talmud study. So that's now moving in and challenging the former place of science and philosophy. One more paragraph.
In fact, by the 13th century, many Spanish Jewish leaders not only shared the intellectual orientation of their brethren to the north, they were also developing a new and profound interest in the spreading notion of pietism and mysticism known as Kabbalah. It has been suggested that the rapid acceptance of this new movement was a definitive rejection of the dazzling, sophisticated Andalusian culture. Indeed, nothing was further from the intellectual Kabbalists than the previous attempts at harmonizing Judaism with foreign cultures. Opportunities for interreligious communication were dwindling in any event, and Jewish creativity turned inward, exploring new and more irrational realms of Jewish religious experience. The scholars working at a vibrant Kabbalistic center established in Gerona included Nachmanides. A Sephardic scholar, Moses de Leon, produced a classic of Kabbalistic thought, the Sefer HaZahar, the Book of Splendor, between 1280 and 1286.
Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you so much. So this burgeoning school of Kabbalah, particularly in the north, Nachmanides, the Ramban, is part of this school of study. So we'll see also in his commentary, we'll see all these things that are highlighted in Jane Berger's reflection. And there are many pages on Nachmanides. I just selected, I think this is, for me, it was perfect. We'll see these things echoed in some of the selections that we'll look at tonight. And all of these issues emerging in his commentary. So I wanted to show you also the book that I photocopied from. This is the first English translation of the Ramban's commentary in English. I mean, the first translation into English. His commentary on the Torah. This is just the volume in Genesis.
Wow.
And and this is only one of, so when he says there, he says, me too. You know, I'm also a philosopher. I'm also learned in Mikra, in sacred scripture. I'm also a doctor. I'm also all these things, you know, but they don't want to hear from it. So this is just like a thumbnail of his work. And in a standard, what's called Mikraot Gedolot, a Hebrew edition of the Chumash, of the Torah, with the standard commentaries, his commentary is a standard part of it. So anyone who studies in Hebrew, the weekly parasha, who studies Torah with commentaries, will be reading the Ramban week in, week out. Okay. Pass these around. And
me, please.
My student pulpit in Simi Valley when I was the first years of rabbinic school, when I left L.A. to come to New York, they gave me a gift of Mikra Gedolot. I wasn't yet a rabbi, but in good faith, they had it subscribed. To share it with loving appreciation from your first congregation. B'nai Amet, 1982-84. So this is the Mikra Gedolot. It's a standard of studying Torah. The block print, the large print, is just a couple verses, and everything else is commentary, of which the Ramban is a critical part. Okay.
Question. In terms of his day, how is this information transmitted?
That manuscript.
Without the printing press.
Manuscripts that were copied. And copied and copied and copied. So obviously there are also errors, and so there are scholars will compile critical editions which will reference the variants in translation and in copying text.
In the Jerusalem 1000 exhibit that was at the Met, mm-hmm. a year or so ago, they had a handwritten book by Maimonides.
Right, I remember that.
It was just looked like it was done yesterday.
The docents wanted to do that. They wanted to talk about that little.
Yeah, it was striking.
So, when Jews get together to study Torah in its widest sense, Jewish learning, you never study alone. You bring people around the table to study with you. So, my first question to us is, when you study important Jewish texts, who would you bring around the table with you? What voices would you want to hear?
Yours.
And I like to study. Thank you. I'm not in the company of the greats, so thank you. And I really love to study with Gunther Plaut's commentary. I think that he brings so much to the text. So I like that commentary. And who else would you want to bring around the table with you?
Jacob Milgram.
Yeah. For Leviticus.
He also did numbers for the
numbers. Was numbers not? I thought it was Leviticus.
Leviticus is the anchor Bible for the JPS, the new JPS Torah. He did numbers. Hmm. And who else would you bring around the table?
I actually wouldn't want to bring anybody so brilliant because I would figure I couldn't follow them, and if I wanted to understand. They write all this beautiful poetry, and I'm going, what'd they say? But if they said, well, then here's my poem, now we're moving on, I would find it, I would find it overwhelming. So I don't think I would want these brilliant people sitting around
tell me all this stuff up. I'm like, what? I want it accessible. I want to find the people who would make it accessible. Now, maybe they did when they studied, but maybe you had to know so much that, you know, it would be hard for those of us with more moderate knowledge to follow.
I agree.
Robert Alter, his translations are delicious to read, and he annotates them.
And he also comes from a literary perspective.
Right.
Alan Robert Alder?
Alter.
Alter.
Abraham Joshua Heschel, because I think that the way he would relate the learned part of it to current thinking would resonate with me, who's not a scholar of these things, and would make me understand it better.
I'd like to study with Sally Prezant, I think. Who's Sally Prezant?
The first woman ordained. Ordained by the Reform Movement. So let's look on the front page. This is meant to be. And so what we're looking at now is Chavel's translation of the Ramban's preface to his own commentary. So it's not Chavel's. Well, actually, this is his. This part is his. We'll get to the Ramban's introduction himself.
Chavel is
the scholar who translated.
Okay.
The translator.
Oh, thank you.
Chavel.
So this is taken from that commentary.
Yes, everything is taken from here. And of course, he refers to him as the Ramban, and then in parentheses, Nachmanides. In Jewish life, he's known as the Ramban. Like Rashi, it's the same, the R is for Rabbi. Rabbi Shlomo, in Rashi's case, Shlomo ben Yitzchak. And this is Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, but known by the acronym.
When was that published?
Sure. 1971, not all that long ago. So the Ramban expressed his position of who he brings around the table in this opening. I will place as an illumination before me the lights of the pure candelabrum, the commentaries of our Rabbi Shlomo, that's Shlomo ben Yitzchak, that's Rashi, a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty adorned in his ways in scripture, Mishnah, and Gemara. The right of the firstborn is his. In his words will I meditate, and in their love will I ravish. And with them we will have discussions, investigations, and examinations. And with Abraham the son of Ezra, Abraham ibn Ezra, ibn is the Arabic, Abraham ibn Ezra, we shall have open rebuke and hidden love. So those are the two he's bringing to his commentary. He doesn't do anything without consulting those two who are figuratively at the table with him. And in his commentary, he's going to reference them all the time. These discussions are all in the first person. Rashi says, Ibn Ezra says, as if they are sitting with us around the table. Jewish Torah study is in the present tense. It's all, and time is flattened, and everything exists in the eternal now. There's no past tense. It's all happening right now, and we are responding over centuries to one another. Okay. At the time Ramban penned the above lines, Rashi's preeminent position in all Talmudic study had been firmly established. For a century and a half preceding the lifetime of Ramban, French and German rabbis had developed in their schools a system of learning known as the Tosafot, literally additions, in which Rashi's exegesis of the Talmud served as the seed from which sprouted extensive critical studies. So as we read in Jane's book, already the influence of Talmudic study from Northern Europe, in this case it's Southern France, but it's north of Barcelona, has become part of the ways of thinking. Next page. So I think there's a lot of reinforcement. I hope An element of pervasive influence in his work is that of the Kabbalah, we don't use that spelling, the mystic teachings of the Torah, which Ramban was the first to introduce into biblical commentary. The great Kabbalist of the 16th century, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, Isaac Luria, spoke of the Ramban's presentation of Kabbalist principles of thought in the highest terms. Deep they lie, exceedingly deep, who can grasp them? The wide extent of Kabbalist influence on the coming generations can be traced to the Ramban, for despite of the word of caution included at the end of his introduction to the commentary, which we'll look at, which warns against reaching into the Kabbalah on one's own initiative, the study of Kabbalist doctrines received a great impetus and became widely diffused because of him. Next page, the Book of Genesis. So, what, again, it's important for us to ask our own questions. If you are beginning the study of Genesis, you know enough about Genesis, enough about the Torah. What are the big questions you would bring to the study of Genesis and to the study of Torah? What are your questions? You know the opening chapters of Genesis. You know how it's going to unfold.
What's the significance of seven days of creation?
Right, and there are no wrong answers here. So what are your questions? Well, look at his. Did it happen that way?
Why give man free will?
Yep. So let's look at his opening. Okay, now this is the voice of Nachmanides, the voice of the Ramban. Mm-hmm. And would someone want to read? We'll just go around the circle. Harold, do you want to read?
The Book of Genesis. Moses, our teacher, wrote this Book of Genesis together with the whole Torah from the mouth of the Holy One. Blessed be He.
Okay, so what question is he answering?
Who wrote it?
Or addressing? Yes. So, he doesn't ever state his question, but he's addressing a question of authorship. We're going to continue. See how we resolve. What are some of his underlying questions, and how is he working to resolve them?
It is likely that he wrote it on Mount Sinai, but there it was said to him, "Come up to me unto the mount, and be there, and I will give thee the tablets of stone, and the Torah, and the commandment which I have written to teach them."
Okay, so now he's going to use the duplication in this verse, the repetition, to say, okay, we have the tablets, the Torah, the commandments. What are all these things referring to? Go ahead.
The tablets of stone include the tablets and the writing that are the Ten Commandments. The commandment includes the number of all the commandments, positive and negative.
Positive and negative mean you shall not. Okay.
If so, the expression and the Torah includes the stories from the beginning of Genesis and is called Torah, teaching. Because it teaches people the ways of faith.
Okay, so what is Torah?
Teaching.
Stories. Teachings that teach people the ways of faith. He's putting out some very subtle, right, nuanced possibilities. Go ahead.
Upon descending from the mount, he, Moses, wrote the Torah from the beginning of Genesis to the end of the account of the tabernacle. He wrote the conclusion of the Torah at the end of the 40th year of wandering in the desert, when he said, "By command of God, take this book of law and put it in the side of the Ark, of the Ark of the Covenant, of the Eternal, your God.
So what are some of the what are some of the things he's putting forth here? Maybe the Torah was actually written down by a person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And maybe it wasn't written all at the same moment. Now, this may seem like a no-brainer, but you don't hear Orthodox people speaking this way today. So you realize how radical he is. And again, he's a revered rabbi, scholar, Kabbalist, the works. So let's keep going a little bit more.
But he's also saying that it's intended to be transmitted. It's not just a record. It's intended to...
Absolutely, yes. But he's also going to couch much of what he says, so he's not going to be... He has to walk a line between intellectual courage and creativity and honesty and heresy. So he's very careful. He's walking that line. And
I didn't remember that it said, I give these tablets of stone and the Torah. I always just thought it was the tablets of stone.
And we can look it up. This is not from, this is from Exodus,
okay, this is from
so
Exodus.
I don't have Exodus here. And
interesting. You're
right,
I'll have to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you
want to
look it up?
Yeah.
Sure.
Because...
That just bothered me. When
yeah.
I don't remember it said that. But what do I know? I mean,
you're questioning the Rambam?
What's the essence?
Yeah. Isn't that a Jewish thing to do?
Absolutely. Exodus 24:12.
Yeah, I thought it was the wrong
thing. We learned when I was a kid that God wrote the Torah, wrote the
right.
Ten Commandments, etc.
Right, and that's a little bit Cecil B. DeMille's version too.
Right.
And we have that in Exodus as well, written by the finger of God.
Yeah.
So but the Torah, for us, the Torah's actually got multiple narratives going on here, and
every single one has got more than one.
So the Ramban is dealing with the multiple narratives. Our kids now, when they learn history, they always ask for multiple narratives, and they're taught differently than you and I might have been taught. But Torah is filled with multiple narratives. What do we have?
This is Exodus 24:12. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the teachings and commandments which I have inscribed to instruct them."
So teaching is Torah.
So I can look at the, you want to look at the Hebrew?
Yeah.
Yeah. Vayomer Adonai al Moshe, Ale Eli Hahara Vehiyesham. It's also, and go up to the mountain and be there. Like, where else would you be if you're already on the mountain? So, of course, the mystical Hasidic traditions go to town on,
and be there.
Actually be there, be present.
Yeah.
Ve'etna lecha et haluchot, et luchot ha'even, the tablets of stone, even, Abba Eben, the Hebrew name Abba Eben, stone, luchot ha'even, v'ha'torah, v'ha'mitzvah, asher katavti lehorotam, which I wrote to teach them.
God wrote to teach them?
Yeah.
Saying God wrote there.
In order to teach them.
Yeah, that's
mm-hmm.
that's
like
very literal
the
way we learned it.
So here, Torah is translated as teaching. And he also understands it that way. He says the Torah is the teaching because it teaches the people the way. So, what can I say to you? Okay. We won't get through everything today, but we're only one night of the Ramban. Okay. And Joyce, do you want to pick it up?
Yeah. Is it from this view accords?
Please.
This view accords with the opinion of the Talmudic sage who says that the Torah was written in sections.
However, according to the sage who says that the Torah was given in its entirety, everything was written in the 40th year when he, Moses, was commanded, "Now write ye this psalm for you, and teach it unto the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths, and as he was further instructed, take this book of the law, and put it in the side of the ark of the covenant of the eternal your God."
So everything is based in text and how you interpret the text. We're not going to stay with it because I want to go. We'll keep going. Alan?
In either case, it would have been proper for him to write at the beginning of the book of Genesis, and God spoke...
You know, we're going to let's finish. It's got genealogy in here, I'm sorry, but we're going to skip this paragraph and go to the next one.
Okay. "Now do not find difficulty in the matter of Deuteronomy, wherein he, Moses, does speak about himself, as he says, 'And I besought the Eternal, and I prayed unto the Eternal,' for the beginning of that book reads, 'These are the words which Moses spoke unto all Israel.' Thus, throughout Deuteronomy, he is like one who narrates things in the exact language in which they were spoken."
One more paragraph.
"The reason for the Torah being written in this form, namely the third person, is that it preceded the creation of the world, and needless to say, it preceded the birth of Moses, our teacher. It's been transmitted to us by tradition that it, the Torah, was written with letters of black fire upon a background of white fire. Thus, Moses was like a scribe who copies from an ancient book, and therefore, he wrote anonymously."
Okay, so what is he doing now?
He's combining the mystical ideas of where the Torah comes from.
Right.
Right.
Both agadic and mystical. So there's an old rabbinic, beautiful midrashic agadah that says that that God created the world with Torah. It's a riff on Reshit. With Reshit, God created the world. Reshit is Torah. Because Torah is called Reshit Chochmah, the beginning of wisdom. So God created the world with Torah. So Torah is like a blueprint. God needed a blueprint. Every architect needs a blueprint. The blueprint was Torah. Torah precedes the creation of the world. He's referencing an old rabbinic midrash in this. So, of course, Torah preceded creation. It preceded the birth of Moses. It's the blueprint from which God created the universe. This Torah was given with black fire on white fire. So everything is open here. So it is mystical, and anyone who would... we'll go to the next page, the bottom of the page. Anyone who wants to hold to the surface literal meaning of the Torah isn't getting it for the Ramban. So this is, even though he's going to stick to every word, every letter, that he'll also assert, he's asserting already, if you're reading it that way, on the surface, you are missing it, because it's black fire on white fire. And Moses was just copying, like his manuscripts were copied, that's what Moses was doing too.
Interesting.
This is just the introduction. Go ahead.
"Everything that was transmitted to Moses, our teacher, through the 49 gates of understanding, was written in the Torah, explicitly or by implication in words, in the numerical value of the letters, or in the form of the letters, that is, whether written normally or with some change in form, such as bent or crooked letters and other deviations, or in the tips of the letters and their crownlets, as the sages have said, 'When Moses ascended to the heaven, he found the Holy One, blessed be he, attaching crownlets.'"
We'll stop right there, attaching crownlets. So, also referencing an early rabbinic midrash, that all those little crowns on letters, there are seven different letters that get the crowns, God was doing that. God was attaching these little crowns to the letters, and someday those little crowns would give rise to mountains and mountains of interpretation. The Ramban is saying, you want to interpret Torah, you have to be able to read what's in those crowns. You have to read how letters are formed, the numerical value of letters, meaning it is infinite. And every letter, every shape, every number is an entrance to a whole world of interpretation. You think this is the Torah? It is not. Okay, next page.
What are the 49 gates of understanding?
Yeah. Also a Kabbalist notion, paralleling the 49 days of the Omer and the 49 days, the 7 weeks that will lead to revelation. So there's a mystical parallel. There are 49 gates of understanding. The 50th is only for, I don't know who.
Yeah, the footnote is interesting on that.
I didn't see the footnote. I mean, I don't remember the footnote.
This was never created, transmitted to any created being. How could the sages say the 50th is for created?
Yeah, so that's the question about the 50th gate. Yeah. No one has ever entered that 50th gate.
Oh.
Okay. The bottom of the next page.
We have yet another mystic tradition that the whole Torah is comprised of names of the Holy One, blessed be He, and that the letters of the words separate themselves into divine names when divided in a different manner. As you may imagine, by way of example, that the verse of Bereshit divides itself into these other words, Barosh Yitzbar Elohim. This principle applies likewise to the entire Torah, aside from the combinations and the numerical equivalents of the holy names.
Okay, so this is another view, that the whole Torah is one big name for God. You think the words are divided this way, but no. You have to put all the words together, and then you're going to read the names of the Holy One. That's another way to read Torah. What was that movie? There was a movie based, this is Abu Lafia's mysticism, The Spelling Bee?
The Bee Season. Richard Gere was the professor and his daughter.
And the daughter who was obsessed with the divine names is coming from this tradition.
Shira.
Yes.
What were these guys, what were they doing? What were they trying to do? And this is not going to lead to, you know, I guess it's the pragmatist in me. This isn't going to lead to a
increase,
a way to set up your, to run your synagogue, or to, you know, to get something done. That this goes on forever, it doesn't seem to have a direction.
It has a direction. It's a wonderful question. So before this time, what we call the golden age of Spanish Jewish poetry, the direction is this way, right? A direction we can relate to, that of science and philosophy, of understanding, of exploration and understanding the world. This one is inverting it, and the direction is inward. So when that world is collapsing, the world of exploring the world out there, and the world of science and reason and logic and mathematics and philosophy, when that is collapsing, the search and turns inward, and the exploration is an inward. It's very directional, but it's an inward direction. We've seen the same thing happen in our lifetimes. So after the height of, like, the age of reason, and, you know, what society had achieved more than Germany with culture and medicine and
art and music,
right? And then we have the Holocaust and World War II, and what follows. And it's also a collapse of, and World War II wasn't just about Jews. What else collapses? So the notion that, if you think, this is the 1964 World's Fair, the GE Carousel of Progress. It's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow. Even though it's post-World War II, we're still in that view of the world every day is better than the day before, and we can make the world better with each day. And progress is like this. It's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow. That was at the end of, right, the 1800s. That was the thrust of the Enlightenment and of Western Europe, that we are all allies, Jews and Christians and Muslims a little bit, that we are all allies in this spiritual brotherhood of man. It's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow. So what is going to collapse? The notion that we are all religious allies, that that tomorrow is necessarily better than today, and that what we know now is necessarily smarter than what was known before, and that human beings are by nature people of reason, and what's going to come to upset that, and Freud is going to come to upset the notion that people are primarily animals of reason, that there's a whole unconscious that's operating. All the assumptions that lead to the age of reason are going to collapse in World War II, that science is the ally of reason for the betterment of humankind. We have the bomb, we have the scientists of Auschwitz. All that, everything. So it's not just Jews whose world collapses, it's the world of the West that collapses. And what are people doing? They go inward. So we have a rise of spirituality. We're seeing it in our own, in the resurgence of Kabbalah, of fundamentalist religion. We have the same thing that happened is happening here. Also, we see it happening now in our own age, the turn inward. Following the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, we have the flowering of Jewish mysticism as all the structures of reason collapse. And we have a rise again in Jewish mysticism and other mysticisms as well today. So, yes, it's a direction, but the direction's inward.
Okay. And is that a good thing?
I don't know.
What was the question?
Is that a good thing?
How long is it going to last?
Right now, observing it without judgment. I don't think we know. Okay.
Scary.
And so let's go to the bottom of the page. In the interest of time, go to the next page.
Page 15.
Page 15. And now, no one see. Who's reading?
Oh, you don't want to read?
Thank you, Ellen.
And now, no one see what I shall answer to those who question me concerning my writing a commentary of the Torah. I shall conduct myself in accordance with the custom of the early scholars to bring peace of mind to the students, tired of the exile and the afflictions, who read in the Seder on the Sabbaths and festivals, and to attract them with the plain meanings of Scripture, and with some things that are pleasant to the listeners and which give grace to the scholars. And may the gracious God be merciful unto us and bless us, so that we shall find grace and good favor in the sight of God and man.
Okay, so what is he saying? Why is he writing a commentary on the Torah?
Really, to help people feel
better,
really. First, the ordinary student and the people who are...
Great. So to bring peace of mind to the students, tired of the exile, right. Because it's life, that beautiful tenuous life is falling apart. You know, that balance, that precarious balance that we've spoken about is now crumbling. And tired of the exile and the afflictions, life is really hard now. Who read in the Seder, in this case Seder is like Sidra or Parasha. So who read the Torah, and so this is meant for regular, you go to services, you're going to have this commentary to read when you go to services and you read the Seder, the Sidra, or the Parasha on Sabbaths and festivals to attract them with the plain meaning of Scripture and with some things that are pleasant to the listeners and which give grace to the scholars. So here, grace, the Hebrew word for grace is chen. So the Hebrew name chana is from grace. But chen is also the acronym for Chokhmah Nistara, hidden wisdom. So, I wouldn't know this except for the footnote. And so you can't read it by yourself. You have to read it with someone who's already read it. So one couldn't read the Ramban, even his introduction, without studying with somebody else who's already studied it with somebody else. So it is a chain of learning that you can never study alone. That you study and then you pass it on to somebody else. And for hundreds of years, Jews have done that. They've gathered around the table. They have brought these people around the table, and they share what they have learned from their teachers. So, and give grace to the scholars. Thanks to Chavel's commentary, I learned that give grace. Chen is, again, chokhmah nistara, hidden wisdom, to the scholars. So some people are reading this for peace of mind, some for the pleasure of the plain meaning of the text, but to scholars, I'm giving another message. And to those who can read on that level, there's hidden wisdom in my commentary. Next page. Isn't that great? Okay.
Becomes very enticing.
And okay, so we have to look at the very end, which was referenced actually earlier. Let's see where we can start. The very end. Into that which is beyond you. Look at that, six lines up.
Into that which is beyond you, do not seek. Into that which is more powerful than you, do not inquire. About that which is concealed from you, do not desire to know. About that which is hidden from you, do not ask. Contemplate that which is permitted to you. Engage not yourself in hidden things.
Okay, so that is warning at the end. Mm-hmm. That Kabbalist learning is only for a few people. This is from, so this is in the bottom, Breishit Rabbah, from an early rabbinic midrash. On, in this case, why does the Torah begin with a bet? It should have begun with what? An olive. But I mean, who thought to ask the question, except people who look at every letter. So they ask, why does the Torah begin with a bet? Think of the shape of a bet. If I'm behind the bet, so don't inquire what came before. Don't inquire what is above. Don't inquire what is below. Only what is in front of you. That's where this is coming from. Okay, so now this is the introduction.
How does that reconcile with the crowns on the letters, which seem to have everything in them?
You have to be of a certain person, a certain level of wisdom, to be able to interpret.
4 years old.
That's not yet, but again, for the
children.
For the few people who are the Mekubalim, the Kabbalists, for them. But for everyone else, no.
But you can strive to reach that, right? Can you?
It depends. We have to watch out. This morning, you really have to watch out. So the whole Kabbalist enterprise is very elitist.
I'm just going to say it.
Extremely elitist, and it gets more and more that way, and more complicated, until the revolution of the Hasidim. So Hasidism will be the revolution that will make Kabbalah accessible to the regular person, but not until then.
When was that? The Hasidim?
1600s. Okay, now the commentary. Okay, that's all right. We'll do a little bit. And so I wanted to take from, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do it in the time we have, but it's okay. I'm telling myself. So I selected both from the beginning of Genesis and also into the beginning of the Joseph story, where we are now in the Torah reading. And we'll do what we can, and you can take it home and we can figure out what to do next. Okay. And first paragraph. Why don't you continue, Maggie? In the beginning.
In the beginning, God created. Rabbi Yitzhak said...
And who's Rabbi Yitzhak?
Rashi.
Okay, so that's Yitzhak. It's Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzhak. So sometimes he calls him Rabbi Shlomo, sometimes he calls him Rabbi Yitzhak. And so right away, he says, these are the people I have around the table with me, and I'm bringing him right away.
Said, go ahead. The Torah, which is the book of laws, should have begun with the verse, "This month shall be unto you the first of the months," which is the first commandment given to Israel.
Okay, so the Torah should have started with Passover.
Right.
Okay.
What then is the reason it begins with creation? Should the nations of the world say to Israel, "You are robbers because you took unto yourselves the lands of the seven nations of Canaan"? They, Israel, may reply to them, "The whole world belongs to the Holy One, blessed be He. He gave it to whom He pleased, and according to His will, He took it, the land, from them and gave it to us."
Okay, so what is he worried about? What is Rashi worried about?
I mean, why is Rashi addressing this? He's worried about being expelled from the land, from where he is in France.
And here's the land. This and land they're talking about is
Israel.
So
the reaction of others.
And so now it's the fight over the land of Israel. And so Rashi is starting off by saying, you know, other nations are going to say about us that we're robbers because we're taking the land of the Canaanites from them. But oh no, we're not. God gave it to us.
But was Rashi talking about
yes.
the Holy Land? Was he mounting a defense of the Holy Land?
Yes.
But when Rashi was writing, it was in Muslim control. It wasn't in Jewish control.
And I think it's still back and forth that the Crusades were already in full operation in Rashi's lifetime.
But the Jews weren't. It was either Muslim or Christian.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly, for sure. So this is a defense of the Jewish right to the land of Israel.
Okay.
So this is the homiletic expositions quoted by Rabbi Shlomo in his commentaries. And
that's so interesting, though, that he would choose, that he would think that the book should begin with Passover. Which would
Rashi?
Be, yeah.
He's also setting himself up for why it begins with.
Right, why choose that of all?
Because it's the first correct mitzvah. And if the Torah is about mitzvah, the first command, that's the first command. All right, we're going to go to the next page. I have to be more selective. Okay, in the beginning.
In the beginning, Rashi wrote, if you wish to explain it, the word Bereshit, in accordance with its plain meaning, explain it thus. At the beginning of the creation of the heaven and earth, and the earth was formless and void, and there was darkness, the Holy One, blessed be He, said, let there be light. If so, the whole text leads into the creation of light.
So this is a whole big deal. We think it was so amazing when we changed the translations from in the beginning God created heaven and earth to when God began to create the heaven and earth, the earth was full of void. We have it right here. So 1,000 years ago, that was their view. That's how it should be translated. Go ahead.
Rabbi Abraham ben Ibn Ezra explained it in an identical way. However, he established that the letter Vav in the word the Haaretz and the earth does not serve as a connecting letter as it normally does.
Okay, we're going to stop there. So you can see that just how the intricacies of over every letter and the people he's bringing into conversation. Next page. Okay, we're actually not going to do the next page. Skip 24. Okay, page 171. All right,
moving right along.
Okay, yes. Okay, so I'm sorry about the dark. It was hard to, without breaking the back of the book, fine, it was hard to duplicate. So the bottom paragraph, we're back to you, David. The sense of the expression?
The sense of the expression. And there he built an altar unto the Eternal, who appeared unto him, is that he gave praise to the glorious name and offered unto him a sacrifice of thanksgiving for his having appeared to him. Until now, God had not appeared to him, neither in a mareh, nor in a machzeh.
So not in a vision, and not in a dream.
Rather, the command, get thee out of thy country,
Lech lecha,
was said to him in a nocturnal dream, or through Ruach HaKodesh.
So this Ruach HaKodesh is the Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit.
It is possible that the expression, who appeared unto him, alludes to the mystery of the sacrifice. The one enlightened in the mysteries of the Torah will understand.
Okay, I chose this just for that end. The Hebrew has two words. That whole last line, the one enlightened in the mysteries of the Torah will understand, it's two words in Hebrew. Hamevin, Yevin. The one who understands will understand. So it's an illusion, and whatever he uses it, and he uses it, means if you've achieved a certain level of enlightenment, you will get what I am saying.
I clearly.
And I'm afraid to tell you that I don't. So, but we would need help, and I would need help from someone who studied it before, from someone else who studied it before, to explain the levels of mystery to which he's alluding. that's not there in the plain text. Okay, next page. Now we're in the Joseph story. So at the bottom, number 15.
And a man found him, and behold, he was straying in the field.
Okay, so this is, we know that story. Yeah. So Joseph is sent by his father, who really sends him to his death and destruction, sends him to get his, bring provisions to his brothers, and wherever Jacob had sent him, the brothers are not there, and Joseph is wandering, and a man found him, found him, and he was straying in the field.
The verse is stating that Joseph was straying from the road, not knowing where to go, and he entered a field since he was looking for them in a place of pasture. Scripture mentions this at length in order to relate that many events befell him which could probably have caused him to return, but he endured everything patiently for the honor of his father. It also informs us that the divine decree is true and man's industry is worthless. The Holy One, blessed be He, sent him a guide without his knowledge in order to bring him into their hands.
Okay, we'll stop there. So we've read that. We read that through Larry Kushner's beautiful rewriting of Angels and Messengers, and what it means to be a messenger, have a peace. So the Holy One, blessed be He, sent him a guide without his knowledge in order to bring him into their hands. So this nameless person is sent by the Holy One. And the notion that an ordinary person is a hidden messenger from the Holy One on a mission. So we have that here. Just wanted to point out something that we know from later, from beautiful texts. It's here in the Ramban.
Don't run off. You're leaving out.
So much.
It also informs us that the divine decree is true and man's industry is worthless.
Yeah, that's got some.
That dismisses the whole idea of free will.
And again, how else could we reframe that? So looking Martin over. Buber, I think it's Buber, said all journeys are destination of which the traveler is unaware. So the sense of that we think what we do, it's all of our own free will, but we're part of something bigger that we're not aware. And, or as Larry Kushner will say, we can try to be someone else. We can play a B part in someone else's movie, or play an A part in our own. That the life fully lived is when free will meets destiny.
Those who understand will understand.
So is there a place? I think it's such a great question, because it is our question. We wrestle with those things. So is there a place where free will and destiny meet up?
I would call it luck. No?
Well, luck is not destiny. That would be something different. Mm.
It brings the two together.
Luck is random.
Random, yeah. Right.
Which is a different notion than destiny.
Free will make the destiny? Mm.
But free will implies that you are completely in charge of everything in your own life. I mean, I guess as Western rationalists, we think, you know, I don't have to be guided by what my community says or by some big person says. I get to make my own choices. I get to choose my own path. I have free will in this issue. And yet, you know, what is that phrase, you know, if you want to see God laugh, make plans? I mean, how many of that happened to all of us? I was going to do this, but then, you know, I got hit by a car. I mean, you know, so now life is completely different from the one I had looked for. So someplace along the line, you need to put the two of them together. Otherwise, you're too far away from each thing. Was saying, well, everything is God's will. I don't have to make any decisions. Like some very religious people, I don't make any decisions. It's God's will. Whatever happens, it's God's choice. I have no responsibility. The other one is I have total responsibility. And that somehow I think as we get old, I mean, particularly as you get older, I think you realize you don't always get free will. Mm-hmm. You don't always choose. I mean, mm-hmm. people, you know, are in jobs they don't like, but they stay in those jobs because they have to earn a living. They have three kids and they have a mortgage. Mm-hmm. So where's their free will?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think people choose to give up parts of their free will. You choose to live in a society with laws. You are giving up parts of your free will.
Right. So that's where I think they're saying you have to meet it someplace. You can't have both extremes. Don't leave you anything.
But that's not divine. If I say I'm going to live in the United States and accept the laws, I'm going to be a member of this congregation and accept the mores, the standards, those are not divine things. Those are societal things I choose to accept. I choose to give up some of my free will. This is different. This is saying that there's a master plan that limits my free will either completely or to a degree. And that I find...
But there is, in a way, right? Because we're all born, I think we're all born Jewish. We were born, you and I were born very close in time together in a certain place, in a certain way. So we have free will, but we have free will within the context in which we were placed. I mean, if we had been born a different time, in a different place, in a different culture, if we had free will, it would be in a different context. So all free will is limited by the initial things that we don't choose.
But that's what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a saying that I don't know if it arises from here. You know, the saying, "Man proposes, God disposes."
Well,
that's.
So all good religion is going to wrestle with that. Maybe it's presumptuous to say all, So the early rabbis in debating this issue of free will and divine and providence will say that everything is in God's hands except the fear of God. It's another way of saying that God controls everything except for people's choice.
So when you get to the fork of the road and you choose right or left.
Meaning nothing is in God. Between God and people always have the power to accept or not accept. And I think this view is that, I really like the way that, again, Larry Kushner had rephrased it, which is that the ultimate free will is in accepting your destiny. Hmm. So you can choose not to accept your destiny. You can exercise your free will, but then you'll be that one who plays a B part in somebody else's movie, as opposed to starring in your own. So there's a place where free will, that encountering your destiny, is both a free will and destiny.
How
does that? Is there some place in where we can understand, even if we don't experience it, that we can understand that notion?
How do we apply that, for example, to the Holocaust? You know. What free will could those people who were subjected to that, they had no free will. I mean, there's nothing they could do other than try to fight it and get killed, you know, whatever. But I mean, they had no choice. I mean, how do you...
I think we can't put ourselves into that circumstance and without having been there ourselves. It's the gap between that experience and our own is too huge. It's why we would read people like Viktor Frankl for someone who experienced and understood from the Holocaust that ultimate human freedom is the power to choose, the power to respond, not to choose your fate, but to respond.
You could respond.
He has the right to say it. We don't. I don't. So I think it doesn't help to understand our own lives by bringing an argument to an extreme which we can't understand. So it's enough to deal with it in our own lives. What would it mean for us, for me, for any one of us? What does it mean to meet my destiny? What does it mean to not get distracted by
being somebody else, but actually being myself. What would that mean? And framing that religiously. Here it's framed religiously that God has a purpose for me. It could be a metaphor. Mm-hmm. You can use it as a metaphor, but that my being on earth isn't random or worthless, that there's a reason, I'm speaking for each of us, there's a reason for each of us to be in this life, and part of what it means to be fully alive is to encounter that reason. Not to wish I were somebody else, but to figure out why I'm here. And that's a meeting of free will and destiny, when we can do that. Even if it's a moment. We can't live in that all the time. And bringing it to the, there's an absurd part of that, that every little thing that happens, God intended, that nothing is a coincidence, including the way the paper is on my table. And that becomes an obsessive compulsive disorder. And that doesn't, so where again, we bring things to an extreme where every little detail, maybe for, again, I don't know that it's possible to live in that. So I would love to go to the next page, but I don't need to go to the next page. So I'm happy to stay here for a few more minutes as we think about these things.
So is there an aha moment when you meet your destiny?
It could be just a moment that you know that you were in a place for a reason. It could be just a moment. Or that you were there to witness something. And you know it when it happens.
But I think also you can look back. Sometimes you don't realize you're at that particular moment, but you realize, you know, that you ran into somebody in the corner and they gave you a piece of information, whatever it might be, and that then changed something that you did, and that sets you on a path to be, you know, a super volunteer or invent a new thing. Or, you know what I'm saying is that you don't know until you go back sometimes. I think that those moments,
where the turning point was.
Where the turning point was.
And right, yeah, those we right. could have, as Alan suggested, we can understand the causal connections between these moments, but it's a leap to say that's part of a divine plan. Those are maybe right. two different things. So yes, this is a statement of faith.
Just recently in Charlottesville, they had the Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan. Was that an aha moment that we have to be aware of? That's going to happen again and again.
Well, it may be an aha moment for you or
yeah,
for me.
It was scary to me. Mm-hmm. Jenny is there. She lives there, and she lives 5 minutes away from where the incident was. And I think to myself, it happened in Charlottesville, which is a fairly open society. Can it happen here? And that was a very scary thing for me. Was that God saying something?
Or what's our response to that?
I don't know.
Well, does that make you
well, that's, yeah. Well, yeah.
Or
that
do we respond
like
to
those
things?
Right.
Does that make you more vigilant than to other instances of people around you in you know?
Racism and
anti-Semitism. Yeah. Well, it doesn't even have to be that. It could be against others.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
I mean, I had an incident this week that's
African-American
racism,
too.
Yeah. I just want to share this one little thing that happened to me this week. So I'm going to the library. I pull in under the parking thing, and I'm going, I don't want to park next to that car, and there's a pillar. I'm going to the space, but I got plenty of room. I don't want to hit it. So I'm pulling in, so it's easier. And just as I'm pulling in, and I park my car, man knocks on my window. He's an older African-American gentleman, and I rolled on my window, say yes, and he says, he hands me his little parking, you know how you have to pay for the parking?
Mm-hmm. Right.
He said, I paid for extra time, would you like my ticket?
How nice.
Oh, wow.
And
how nice.
It was one of those, this is like a pay it forward moment.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, who does that, you know? So I thought, I mean, I thanked him profusely, I said, thank you so much, and then I got out of the car, he was still sitting there, he rolled down the window. And I said, you know, that was so nice of you to do that. I said, you know, the way things are going, we got to watch our pennies. You know, it's 50 cents. I mean, it only saved me 50 cents.
But that
man's thoughtfulness and generosity made my entire day. You know, I mean, it was nothing. But it you just sort of go, well, where did that come from?
Okay, we're going to squeeze in one more thing. I know it's late. Next page. Okay. So we're not going to read the whole. This is now the story of Judah and Tamar, and Onan spills his seed, so he's not going to sleep with Tamar. And
he does.
All right. So that's the top of the page, and then the bottom paragraph. The subject is indeed one of the great secrets of the Torah concerning human reproduction, and it is evident to those observers who have eyes to see and ears to hear.
Evident.
And, pardon me?
It's evident.
It is evident to them. And this is, so, he's questioning how could Onan know that the seed would not be his? By the law of levirate marriage, of course, would that be an issue? So the reference, again, the footnotes help, which is the transmigration of souls. And just again, it would definitely not evident to me. But the issue of whose seed is whose is part of the story. This is one of the great secrets of the Torah, and he's referencing the doctrine of the transmigration of souls, of Gilgul HaNefesh, which is central to Kabbalah. The book, by the way, written by Moses de Leon, that Sefer HaZohar is the Zohar, which was authored in 13th century Spain in the 1200s, and that circle in northern Spain of which Nachmanides was a part. It is cast as a book which takes place in the 2nd century with Shimon Bar Yochai as its author. That's how the book is cast. He did not let it be known that he was the author. It has a whole pseudo, false authorship cast. And Shimon Bar Yochai was also a mystic, 2nd century. But all scholars agree now that it was written by Moses de Leon as part of the circle, the major work of Kabbalah, which is a commentary on the Torah also. We do have to stop. It's late. So all the different layers to his commentary, he talks about science and about astronomy and mysticism, but leaning more and more to the school toward the internal, away from the spectacular engagement with the external world to a different engagement with the internal world. And we see that move in his commentary in the 1200s and 13th century Spain. I wish everyone a happy Hanukkah. You can take some gelt with you.